WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. Two police chiefs in the Valley are fired on the same day. The Blue Ridge Parkway is closed as officials combat misinformation about the response to Helene. And for a preview of this week's Books and Brews, we speak with the author of a story about a ghost that isn't really a ghost story. This is the WMRA Daily for Monday, October 7th. Local police chiefs have been dismissed. Winchester dismissed Amanda Behan as chief of police on Friday. The Winchester Star reports a city press release offered no reason for the firing. Behan, a Winchester native, was the city's first female police chief. She had been with the Winchester Police Department since joining as a recruit in 2001. And Broadway's town council voted Friday night to fire the town's chief of police, Doug Miller, effective immediately. WHSV reports that the emergency meeting was called for the specific purpose of voting on Miller's job. Council did not say what led to the firing, except to announce in a statement that, quote, the town's police department will benefit from new leadership. Some residents attending the meeting spoke out against the decision. The town was cleared of wrongdoing by the Virginia State Police earlier this year, following an allegation of missing funds. After completing the investigation, VSP determined that no money was missing or misused. The entire length of the Blue Ridge Parkway in Virginia and North Carolina has been temporarily closed due to damage from Tropical Storm Helene. Cardinal News reports that the National Park Service says that 250 Park Service employees from 32 states and D.C. were joining with Parkway staff in recovery efforts. The most severe damage stretches from milepost 280 to milepost 469 in North Carolina. The National Park Service said in some cases the damage is, quote, catastrophic. In some places, part of the roadway was washed away. Crews are almost finished assessing sections in Virginia, and you can find updates on the parkway at the NPS website. State and federal agencies are working around the clock to get resources to parts of Virginia damaged by Helene, but misinformation is also spreading. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Cutner asked Governor Glenn Youngkin about getting reliable information to the public.
Misinformation, rumors, and hoaxes about the government's response to Helene have been spreading online since the storm hit last week. I asked Governor Glenn Youngkin if he'd seen any evidence of one such rumor that federal agencies are blocking volunteers from helping.
So I have not seen that in Virginia, and I have to say the coordination on the ground has been spectacular.
Youngkin said communications are being restored. Of the nearly 300 cell towers the storm knocked out, only about a dozen still need to be fixed. He hopes linking folks back to the rest of the world will give everyone a clearer picture of the situation on the ground.
When we find ourselves in those moments where you're desperate and you can't get answers, that's where confusion and misperceptions can be unleashed.
Corey DeMuro is with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. She's part of the Virginia Recovery Team and said the agency has a rumor response website to address misinformation.
Encouraging survivors and communities to ensure they're verifying where their sources of information, right? Your local officials are your best source of information.
You can go to FEMA.gov to find details about known rumors. And if you've been impacted by Helene, you can apply for assistance there too. In Richmond, I'm Brad Cutner.
Climate scientists say that climate change made Helene more dangerous and deadly. But Governor Glenn Youngkin said blaming the storm on climate change was a distraction. The Virginia Mercury reports that recovery efforts continue in Southwest Virginia, the hardest hit part of the state. Youngkin urged residents who have experienced damage or loss to call 800-621-3362 or go to FEMA.gov. A spokesman for the Virginia Department of Emergency Management said that 519 homes had been counted as damaged so far, with 44 destroyed. That's in Virginia. And those numbers are expected to climb. Two people died in the wake of the storm. Youngkin's comment about climate change came during a press conference near Richmond on Friday. Meanwhile, the list of localities in Southwest Virginia under a federal major disaster declaration has grown from 7 to 9. Cardinal News reports that Montgomery and Pulaski counties joined the list on Saturday. Residents with Helene-related losses in those areas can apply for assistance at FEMA.gov or disasterassistance.gov. Virginia hospitals are dealing with a national IV fluid shortage in the wake of Helene. Patrick Larson with VPM News reports.
Baxter International supplies about 60% of the nation's IV fluid out of its Western North Carolina manufacturing site. That is, until the facility was inundated by Hurricane Helene's floodwaters. Julian Walker with the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association says health systems are working with the government through the Virginia Healthcare Emergency Management Program.
That program works to be ready for, to have resources for situations that have a widespread public health impact.
Walker says it's still too early to know what the impacts of the fluids shortage will be, but they'll vary based on the needs of different hospitals. University of Virginia Health, the region's only level one trauma center, announced over the weekend it was postponing some elective surgeries scheduled for Monday and Tuesday. Baxter International said last week it has hundreds of federal workers at its site near Asheville. No timeline is available for when IV fluid production will restart.
Patrick Larson reporting. 10 days after Helene poured rain on communities throughout the Southeast, some are still without access to grocery stores or doctors. One community in Virginia devastated by flooding is the town of Damascus. There, the nonprofit Health Wagon has been going door to door checking on people. WEHC's Ivy Shepherd has been traveling along with them and has this story.
You might know Damascus if you've ridden a bike on the Virginia Creeper Trail or hiked the Appalachian Trail. This small community in Washington County of 700 people is surrounded by beautiful mountains and a creek that runs through the center of downtown. Nobody lost their lives in Damascus as a result of Helene, but many were rescued. Others remain cut off in their homes, while some, who've lost everything, are sleeping in tents. Mark Handy is a doctor from Abingdon, and he's been working with the Health Wagon to bring medical supplies and care to people in the region.
Mainly elderly people who cannot get out, and their roads are washed out, they have no power. Devastating thing about a lot of these people too as well, they're on oxygen and they can't run their concentrators. We're trying to get them tanks up there too as well.
57-year-old Sheila Richardson says the medical assistance has been a welcome relief.
And I'm just blessed. There's good that comes out of everything.
It's not yet clear how this town can ever rebuild after the flood or how long the recovery will take. Officials and volunteers are busy checking on residents to ensure basic needs are met until roads are safer in and out of this Appalachian town. In Damascus, I'm Ivy Shepherd.
One of the four giraffes at the Natural Bridge Zoo has been moved to a sanctuary out of state, but now the Virginia Court of Appeals has put transfer of the other three on hold. Cardinal News reports it's the latest development in a nearly year-long legal saga involving the roadside attraction in Rockbridge County. The fate of the other three giraffes, which had been scheduled to be moved soon, now rests in more court hearings over the coming weeks. Last December, state authorities raided the zoo and seized its animals as part of an animal neglect and abuse case. But because giraffes are difficult to move, the four animals remained at the zoo. Their case is complicated by the fact that two of them are now pregnant. The appeals court gave the state until October 15th to reply to the order blocking the transfer. As the specter of violence hangs over this election season, faith leaders are calling for peace at the end of the campaign trail. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
When the Prophet Muhammad was expelled from his home in Mecca, he became an asylum seeker, says Virginia Muslim Civic League director Charles Turner.
His companions came to him and they asked, "How shall we relate to the inhabitants of this city?" And the first thing that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, responded is to go out amongst the people and spread the greetings of peace.
Now, Turner is part of an interfaith coalition saying peace be upon you during a tense election season. Here's Baptist Fellowship coordinator Mark Snipes.
There is no room for violence. Again, there is no room for violence. We cannot give in to fear and despair. We cannot give in to a mindset that tears us apart. May we move forward with hope and not fear, with faith and not despair. And may we live out a better way of living.
The coalition is led by Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy Chairman Anthony Flood.
As faith leaders, we are choosing to promote peace in a season when difference of perspective too easily leads to destructive communication and violence. Peace is our choice.
Faith leaders are also participating in Souls to the Polls, Sunday voting at various locations across Virginia. I'm Michael Pope.
A protest over the war in the Middle East this past April at Virginia Commonwealth University resulted in 13 arrests. Six of those arrested were VCU students. A deal to dismiss the charges has been reached between the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office and defense attorneys. Megan Pauley with VPM News has the latest.
The deal required those arrested to submit essays about what they would have done differently to legally exercise their First Amendment rights, in addition to completing 40 hours of community service. Charges were dropped this morning for seven protesters after these conditions had been met, and more dismissals are pending. Attorney Alex Taylor said he was proud to represent three of the protesters because they were advocating for a cause.
It wasn't that many years ago when there were students that looked a lot like me advocating on behalf of a civil rights movement.
VCU students are also subject to disciplinary proceedings through the university's conduct office. A spokesperson for the university said they would not discuss potential disciplinary proceedings or actions for individual students, but confirmed that President Michael Rao did not get involved in the court proceedings.
Megan Pauley reporting. And finally today, Virginia author Abigail Cutter tells the story of a Confederate soldier whose own personal war follows him into the afterlife, until one day when his encounters with a modern-day couple change everything. Abigail talks about the book tomorrow night for WMRA's Books and Brews at Winchester Brew Works. WMRA's Chris Boris asked Abigail about the old Valley farmhouse she lives in that inspired the story.
The first night that we spent in the house, we had some unusual things happen, which indicated that somebody else was in the house besides us. So I awakened to the sound of footsteps, boots crossing the room below. So I started doing some research, but very quickly, the book became more than the story of a ghost. It became the story of the war in the valley. And my main character, Tom Smiley, joins the Confederate Army just at the beginning. He's only 18 and he's looking for adventure and quickly comes to regret his decision. But by then it's too late. The Confederacy had established a draft. So he realizes that he's fighting to protect the interests of wealthy landowners and slave owners. So Tom Smiley then stupidly causes the death of a helpless man. And so he thinks he's going to go to hell. And this is really a 150-year coming-of-age story of this character, Tom Smiley. But it very much reflects places in the valley that your listeners know well.
And Tom Smiley is a character in your book, but he was a real person?
I base this book loosely on my husband's great-grandfather, but more directly on a composite of boys from letters and diaries that are in just a brilliant website created by Ed Ayers.
And in the book, there is a character named Phoebe, and she kind of interacts with Tom Smiley, who is technically a ghost in the book.
The ghost narrates the story. Yes, and Phoebe and her husband are contemporary people who move into this house that's been deserted for many years. They begin to take things out of the house, things that hold his memories. So Tom tries to frighten them away, but he's unsuccessful. So she decides that she has to find a way to get rid of him, since she's going to stay, and she finds a way to communicate with him.
There are still some things that happen in the house, though, when you're there. I mean, doors still open and close, and you hear sounds and things, or is that pretty much done?
Well, it all changed about halfway through writing the book. It changed from being angry, the slamming and stomping, to sheets being turned down in a hotel wedge, on the beds, a rocking chair rocking. And a number of other things that were completely different. And then I didn't hear anything for about 8 years. And then finally, I guess last fall, I decided I'd spend the night in the house by myself. And I was telling a neighbor that I was going to come back and spend the night in the house by myself. My husband was traveling. And as I said that, we have metal storm windows on the house. And an upstairs window, you know, you have to push, you know, click, click against the release. And then you can hear the sound of the metal slide up the window, you know, as the metal frame goes up. And I heard that. It's in some ways, it validates the fact that there are things we can't see, that the world is not just everything our five senses bring us, but perhaps much more. And I like that.
Yeah, yeah, I think I would too. And I wonder, did you have any experiences prior to this? And has this sort of like opened your mind to the possibility that, yeah, maybe there is something after this life or something, like you said, we just don't quite understand?
No, I've always thought that.
Yeah.
And even as a child, had experiences that made me think there was more than just our five senses bring us. But other people have had similar experiences to mine in the house, not my husband.
Your husband has had no experiences?
Never.
Wow.
None.
What does he think about your experiences?
Well, I mean, he knows me quite well.
Right.
So, and one of the reasons I married him was because he was accepting of who I was. And so I think he's interested and he's not altogether disbelieving, but he's just never had any experience of it.
I wonder if he's a little jealous. Like, why doesn't he want to talk to me?
I don't know. I'll ask him.
When someone reads your novel, what do you hope they take away from it?
So I was deeply influenced by a book called The Things They Carried, which is really a classic of Vietnam War fiction that was written 20 years ago. And it's about ordinary people, some of whom didn't want to fight, who were forced to be in the circumstance and the effect it had on the rest of their lives. I wanted people to think a little bit about the Civil War that way. So that's what I want people to take away from it, is what that experience has on the everyday soldier, the people who have nothing to gain from war.
Abigail Cutter is the author of The Last of What I Am, and she is our speaker for Books and Brews tomorrow night in Winchester at Winchester Brew Works at 7 p.m. We have details at WMRA.org. Abigail, it's been lovely speaking with you, and good luck with the book, and enjoy that house.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
To hear a longer version of that interview and to get details about tomorrow night's Books and Brews in Winchester, visit WMRA.org. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Monday.